That's just a deep recording, man.
Yeah, brother, like, solid. Right on.
Welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Hey, good morning to you, Connor. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good.
Well, that's always good when Connor is doing good.
Yeah.
Right? Right, doing well. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host Sandy Williams. How you doing, Sandy?
Well, I'm doing well.
Yeah. Okay. You're not doing good.
No. I'm sure. I'm trying to use adverbs.
Am I being improper? Oh, wow. Looks like you're gonna have to kick me off the show now.
You know. You know, I was at the. The Brewer game yesterday afternoon, it was a 1 o'clock game. They played the Los Angeles Dodgers, and must have been Senior's Day or something.
Right, because you were there, you mean?
A lot of seniors were there.
Ah.
But I would think that who else can go to a game at 1 o'clock in the afternoon? Except for maybe seniors, right? I mean, they're not a, you know.
They aren't marketing fools.
No, they must have it figured out. I guess when you're looking at, you got the hottest team and the best team in baseball. The Dodgers don't come here that often.
Wait, are the Dodgers the hottest and best team in baseball?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Their record is... is something real crazy, like 84-31.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, they are really one of the greatest, best teams in baseball. And they rarely come to Milwaukee. You know, they're every couple, 3 years or so.
Are they aren't the Brooklyn Dodgers anymore?
Are you serious?
No.
Come on.
No, I'm not serious.
So they came, and
most of the radio listeners wouldn't even know that they were ever
was Brooklyn Dodgers.
They were ever the Brooklyn Dodgers.
You know, so the Dodgers are in town. That is a great baseball team, and you know, you would think that there would be a sellout every one of those four games, but they had 38,000 people there yesterday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow.
That means they're marketing geniuses, Sandy, is the point, right?
Yeah.
Because if you don't figure out some kind of way to get those people in the stands on a Thursday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it was a great crowd. And more than anything else, Sandy, it was perfect weather.
And who won the game, just to show you that I don't follow?
Well, the Brewers won the game.
Uh-huh.
And so out of the four-game series, they split it down the middle. So, they split it down the middle.
Does Pee Wee Reese play for the... I just remember that name because what a great name. Pee Wee Reese. He was the shortstop for the Brooklyn Dodgers, I believe.
Hey, Sandy.
Yeah. I'll stop.
Pee Wee Reese. I know. So I remember... Tommy Lasorda.
Uh-huh.
You remember that guy?
Well, but he was a manager for the Yankees, but he was also, or the Dodgers.
Yes.
But did he play for the Dodgers?
No. But I just remember, you know, him always as a, well, the Dodgers had great Sandy Koufax.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yep.
Just one of the greatest pitchers of all time. Had a short career.
Well, he had arthritis in his throwing elbow, and he kept getting cortisone shots, and it began to, his elbow began to deteriorate from the cortisone shots, so he retired prematurely.
Yeah, he was actually one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And back in those days, so since I'm watching you know, the game, and I watched the Brewers. So their top pitcher, Corbin Burnes, was pitching. He's now 9-5. He won the game, and he has a 2.3 ERA, which is a great ERA in baseball. He's 9-5. He's pitched a lot of innings. But what I notice, and I've been noticing the difference in when you and I used to watch baseball, the pitchers would pitch however many innings it took.
Yeah.
They'd be on the mound in the 10th inning.
Sure. Warren Spahn won 26 games in one year season, and I think they were almost all of them complete games where he pitched all nine innings.
And Warren Spahn won 300 games. So those guys were horses back then, you know.
Well, they didn't try to throw, and none of them could throw.
Curveballs and split fingers.
None of them could throw 93 miles an hour and didn't do it repeatedly. I mean, Warren Spahn had a whole bunch of different pitches.
What they called junk,
yeah,
right?
None of them were very fast.
Well, you can look at a guy like Phil Niekro, who threw a knuckleball, one of the first guys to throw a knuckleball. And so you're watching.
He was the reason Bob Uecker was in the major leagues, because Bob Uecker's one thing he could do is he could catch a knuckleball pitcher.
Right. But people who don't know, the knuckleball might be going at 70 miles, 65 miles an hour.
Right, but it flopped around unpredictably.
So you got a guy. But they did have power pitchers. They had guys like
Ryan Duren. Remember him? Oh, you're looking. Ryan Duren pitched for the Yankees, but he was very, very nearsighted and wild. and people were afraid of him. His main weapon was that the batters were all afraid that he'd hit them with a 94 mile an hour pitch. His practice pitches before a guy stepped up were always like up into the screen.
well, that's just what you want as a guy who's got eyesight's not the greatest, and he can throw 94 miles an hour.
Yep.
But, you know, they had guys like, who's the guy for St. Louis Cardinals?
Are we talking about a pitcher here?
Yeah.
Gibson?
Bob Gibson. He could throw. What?
I'm just pointing at myself. I remember Bob. You know,
oh, yeah.
I'm not a baseball fan, and I pulled Bob Gibson out of an orifice.
Because Bob Gibson could throw it 90, 92, 95 miles an hour back then, uh-huh. And it'd be the 14th inning, and he'd still be out throwing. But those guys were just different. And so I was talking about Corbin Burnes. He pitches about 5.5 innings.
Well, they count
a game.
They count pitches. And
yeah,
something like 90 pitches, and then they come out of the game.
Yeah, and I guess it's the investment is what they're looking at. They're saying we're paying this guy all of his money. We don't want him injured, so we're going to control, how many pitches.
Well, I think with all the data they've got, they keep track of how fast that fastball is going and all the different information. So maybe it is that the batters have gotten better as well. But, baseball is data-driven now. And it's data-driven on how long pitchers pitch, I think, just as much as it is on who it is that is on the payroll.
Yeah, Sandy, the data clearly, it's what's going on. They've got a lot more guys whose job it is that's on the team in the dugout to do just that. Job is to track the pitches. What kind of pitches? Because some of those pitches that they throw put a lot of stress on the elbow. And what was the name of the surgery that they...
Tommy John.
Tommy John surgery. And so you're doing pretty good. I mean, I know what you got pretty good recall. And so the Tommy John.
Well, and it was named after the pitcher, Tommy John, on whom it was first done.
Yeah. And so now all these different things, and guys can blow their arms out you know, they throw these strange pitches, as you stated, that do all kind of stuff. They come at you like it's a fastball, and yet it's a fastball at 98 miles an hour, yet it's a
forkball?
Split-fingered or change-up, and it looks the same as the fastball, and the hitter's there standing, and the guy just threw a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. He's got to get his bat started early, right? And then all of a sudden, the next pitch is 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it looks just like the 98 mile
an hour. Well, the other thing is that the batting averages in the major leagues have gone way down. So they don't worry that much about the batting average. They look at on-base average and all sorts of other information.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, Sandy, we're here talking about baseball. And I'll tell you something. I like watching the game of baseball. But sometimes,
You have to like peanuts.
Yeah. Well,
you have to like something else other than sports to really like baseball,
so,
I think.
So, now that you mention that, when you go to the games, that's why there are as many women in the stands as there are sometimes anything else. And you know why? There's entertainment at the baseball game. There's entertainment during the breaks. In between innings, they've got all this entertainment.
The sausage race.
Yeah. So the sausage race. When the sausage race comes.
Yeah, Dunkin' Donuts race.
Yeah, you know, and everybody stands up, and they've got their cameras, and they're filming, recording the sausage race.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't believe this, but
the fellow who heads the rowing program where I coach is getting married shortly. But his stag party involved him riding his bike out to the the field and running in the sausage race.
Right. Listen,
he was the bratwurst.
We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host Sandy Williams. We'll get into some stuff. After the break. Be right back. As always, to the Earl Ingram Show, as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. My co-host is Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I was looking at this, and I couldn't help but think about you because you've been talking about these kind of things for a long time. It's actually in The Hill this morning, and it says, job seekers with no degrees but plenty of skills need and deserve more. And so I got to thinking, so what are they talking about? With fierce competition for talent in today's labor market, many employers ask if a college degree is really necessary. They rage from giants like Google to small companies in the nation's heartland. For example, Central Iowa Vapors in Cedar Rapids recently decided that new hires no longer need degrees after a star manager trainee revealed that he never even graduated high school. Sometimes you think, Sandy, there, and depending on what type of job, clearly, there's some jobs that you, without question, have to be degreed on. But, you know, we're talking about the brilliance of Connor, our guy Connor.
Mm-hmm.
You can't teach what he has, right? I mean,
you don't want to.
Story of my life.
you know, there are people in the society, Sandy, that businesses may make a mistake on, because they don't see what the person could be, and I guess they don't have time for that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've been thinking recently that, you know, I've talked earlier about how the job market morphed away from what it was when you and I got into
right.
it, where businesses all had training programs.
Right.
Notice what they're talking about now. They're all talking about training people on the job.
Yes.
And in fact, I've got the guy that is does the HVAC stuff at my house is talking about how short they are and how much training he provides now on the job training. And it's, I think this whole job market situation is going to take businesses back to training on the job and working on ways to keep job loyalty amongst their employees, keep longevity on the job, because you lose an employee today, it's very hard to replace
right.
them. And so they're doing much more work on maintaining the longevity of employment relationships. And I think that the current job market is going to take employers back to what must have caused the employment model when you and I started working. You know, the shortage of workers coming out of World War II and during World War II, I think, got all these businesses into the mode of training people,
right.
developing long-term relationships with the people. I think that was more of a post-World War II kind of a phenomena. And I think we're getting back to it. I think that employers are going to work much harder on maintaining the relationship, the employee relationship they have, so they don't have to have a revolving door, because when someone walks out the door, it's hard to replace them.
You know, Sandy, that had to be what it was when you and I were young, because, you know, you talked about World War II, the shortage, the fact that corporations had to compete with the labor market, where, you know, so many guys were in the military and they had to be tolerable.
They flooded the job market when they came back World War II. But the U.S. economy was ready to burst, because we had been through this long period of shortage during World War II, ration books and everything. So there was a whole lot of pent up demand. So when World War II ended, there was a burst of demand, and there was a great rapid conversion from military production to domestic production, and there was a shortage of workers because everyone needed to retool, right? And so, yeah, the condition was different in the 50s. And there had been a situation before the Depression where, you know, it used to be that people took jobs for a lifetime career. That was,
right.
But they didn't do it. They did it out of sort of, that's the way things were. It was a cultural thing. After World War II, it was really, I think, sort of an economic necessity thing. That necessity dropped away in the 70s, employers thought, because they had layoffs, and the whole world changed in about 1970, and that we developed a world of layoffs during recessions that didn't used to occur. It just used to be that profits went down more because you kept your employees, and after about 1970, you avoided that to the extent you could because you laid them off.
But Sandy, the system worked because those pensions were at the end of that rainbow. And for people, there was incentive, right?
To stay.
Yeah. And the companies kind of had that hook in, too, because, and they were more tolerable, I think, Sandy,
yeah.
with their workforce. And so we changed all of that. Now you say we may be going back to some of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we dropped pensions at the same, you know, in the 80s and 90s, we began to drop that kind of benefit, replacing it with 401k contributions,
right.
and then they got more and more skinny in terms of the amount that the employer would give to 401ks as they tried to test the market. You know, people felt like they were stuck in their jobs before the pandemic. I think the world has changed. I think we'll find out now that there'll be larger 401k contributions. There's going to be a much greater effort to keep people in their jobs once they get trained and are working successfully.
You know, Sandy, the operative thing you said is, didn't say changing, you said has changed. And so the transformation has kind of taken place.
Oh, I think we're in the middle of it.
Okay.
I think we're feeling the effects of it right now. I think we're right at the leading edge, because employers, you know, they started out by offering bonuses. Bonuses are a way to avoid giving raises that are permanent.
Right.
But Bonuses didn't work very well. Now they've also realized the importance of keeping employees.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. That's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. You can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. He's my co-host. Our phone lines are open as always at 844-967-2789. You know, Sandy, I was, my mind was wandering, and as it's wanting to do sometimes. And the John Birch Society popped in my head. Don't ask me why the John Birch Society popped in
my head. Well, we are here in Waukesha, and the John Birch Society had its birthplace, I believe, with some Waukesha families.
Oh, hold on. Yeah. I forgot. My guest is on the line. None other than the governor.
Ah.
Who will be joining us post-haste. I'm saying, who is this calling? Right? And it is Governor Evers. Hey, good morning to you, Governor Evers. How you doing, my friend?
Been a long time. I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm always doing better when the governor takes the time out of his busy schedule to give us a call.
Well, thanks so much, Earl. Appreciate coming on and chatting with you.
It's always great to have you on. You got a couple things you want to talk about.
Well, certainly, just one in a couple things in particular. One is the spending the last week going around the state talking to people about their private wells. Most people wouldn't believe this, and I had a hard time believing it too, but there's 800,000 private wells in the state of Wisconsin, and many of them are struggling with nitrates in the water, and you know, we want to make sure people are drinking clean water in the state of Wisconsin. And so what we put together is a $10 million program that helps people with the real expense here. It's about $16,000 to fix a well these days. And the bottom line is we believe it's important for people to have clean drinking water, and if their water is testing badly, which happens quite a bit, we figure that this $10 million will help clean up well over 1,000 wells in the state of Wisconsin. And it's not just homes, it's also in rural areas. We have churches and we have bars and restaurants and daycare centers that are on private wells. So this impacts all sorts of people across the state. So we've been working on that this week. That's one of the, one of our initiatives. We believe that clean water is really important for people, and that kind of flows into the issue of lead laterals in Wisconsin. And one of the things that we're really excited about is that we're going to be receiving dedicated funds from President Biden's infrastructure law for lead service.
Really?
Yeah, lead service. Yeah, really. And, you know, I in my budgets, I over the last couple of years, proposed $40 million in my most recent proposal, and about the same the first time around. Of course, the Republicans knocked it right out of the budget, so that never happened. But we anticipate getting about $48 million to the state of Wisconsin. That's going to really speed up our lead service line replacement for our project.
You know, that's great. Let's talk about the pushback from a few Republicans on your plans to use the opioid money to address the opioid problems in the state.
Yeah. Go figure, right? Yeah, the work of the Attorney General was really significant, and we put together a plan that we had to get approved by the Joint Finance Committee. It's a process that, frankly, is shrouded in lots of malarkey, frankly. But at the end of the day, it's really important. We Wisconsinites across the state have obviously felt firsthand the effects of the opioid epidemic, and we've put the Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee, objected to the state plan, and didn't say why. They just said no. And so we have this money sitting around that could go directly to people and, you know, municipalities, health departments, whoever does the work, to getting people in treatment and support and giving them the services they need. But apparently there is no hurry on the part of the Republicans and Joint Finance Committee, because they're holding up millions of dollars that would be going out the door to save lives.
You know, Governor Evers, I remember reading, I think, the opioid deaths from opioid is almost kind of like the number one killer.
Right.
And you just don't understand why anybody would be opposed to that, because it impacts and affects everybody across the state. There's not one area that these deaths and the opioid problem doesn't impact. So you wouldn't expect people across this state in the legislature, wherever they're from, the opioid crisis is there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it defies logic. Yeah, I don't know if it's they think that they'll be giving the administration preventing us to have a win. The win is for the people of Wisconsin. That's the problem. And even if they would said, well, this is what we object to, and this is our suggestions, it's just a no. And we'll come back to you later. And this is they call it an epidemic for a reason, because it is. Lots of people are hurting. This money should be going out the door. Should have been going out the door yesterday, but instead we wait. And the secrecy of the Joint Finance Committee around this issue and other issues is just atrocious, and just another example of people wanting power, I guess.
You know, Governor Evers, I know you got to run, but our doors are always open, and certainly we've got to get you reelected. And so, again, at any time, you can call, and the listening audience is waiting to hear from you.
Earl, we'll take advantage of that as always, and thanks for your good work too. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Governor Evers. Really appreciate that. You know, Sandy, I'm sitting here and I'm looking, and I'm saying, I wonder who this is calling. Right? I wonder who this is calling, and it turns out that it's the governor. Right.
I didn't believe him when he said that it was him. I was like, the governor, Governor Tony Evers.
Yeah. That's so. What was that, Sandy?
We got fans.
Someone took our picture.
We have fans.
Hey, the guy pulled up in a truck.
Well, you know, for all we know, that's Dave or
no,
CJ
that's I know who he is. But anyway. Sandy, let's talk about the John Birch Society. Where is it at? There it is. And I had this, it popped in my mind about, and I remember reading about the John Birch Society long ago. And for whatever reason, the correlation between some of and how the Republican Party changed from the Republican Party that we used to know, 40 years ago. You know, there's been some changes in it, right?
Yeah,
I mean, drastic changes. And so for those who don't know, about the John Birch Society, Sandy. Let's talk a little bit about what that is, what that was. Well, it's still around.
Well, I think it's still around. The John Birch Society, my recollection, this is a cold brain just recalling, was that it was in the mid to late 50s. And it was founded by some business folks who had businesses actually out here in Waukesha. And it was aimed at, because the feeling in the 50s was that the Republican Party was very close to the Democratic Party. They were both centrist parties. And in fact, when Dwight Eisenhower was considering running for president, when he stepped out of the military in the late 40s after World War II, and it was clear that he was going to go into politics, he was toying with either running for president as a Democrat or as a Republican, and finally decided to run as a Republican. But that was a demonstration of how close the parties sort of were. So the John Birch Society was a sort of shadowy group that decided they would get together and they would try to exert influence on the Republican Party to move it in a much more conservative direction, which ultimately was the Barry Goldwater emergence as a leader of the nominee in 1964. So, you know, the move from Dwight Eisenhower to Barry Goldwater was quite a remarkable shift to the right. Some of that was probably attributable to the operation of the John Birch Society. But the John Birch Society was sort of treated as like a bit of a kooky and secret, sort of secretive organization. And, you know, other than being able to identify some of the leaders of it who were related to a couple of businesses out here in Waukesha, there wasn't a lot that people talked about other than people would mention the John Birch Society as sort of the initiator of conservatism. And to some extent, the Bradley Foundation might well be an offspring of the John Birch Society.
And at the root of it was the Constitution. And so making sure that Constitution was, you know, stood for, well, was interpreted in a manner commensurate with what we're talking about now in the Republican Party. You know, there was a workshop that they conducted. The Constitution is the solution. And so that was a lot of what was at the root of it. And then, Sandy, it took more hold and more shape in Texas. Texas was the place where, even though it was founded here in Waukesha, Texas, there was some... What is it about Texas? Texas was the place where they began to take hold. People know of the John Birch Society, that the far-right group founded in the thick of the Cold War to fight communists and preach small government. It's purely as a historical relic of a bygone era of sock hops and poodle skirts. But the John Birch Society lives. And though it's not the same robust organization it was in the 1960s heyday, when by some accounts, it had as many as 100,000 dues-paying members around the country and 60 full-time staff. After decades of declining membership and influence, the Birchers insist they are making a comeback, and they point to Texas as the epic center of their restoration. There definitely is an increase in our activities, particularly in Texas, because Americans are seeking answers, but they can't quite put their fingers on what some of the real problems are, says Bill Hahn, the John Birch Society's vice president of communications. Carter, the head of the Central Texas chapter, says that statewide the group's membership has doubled. Now, in the quest, they have common cause with powerful allies in Texas, including Senator Ted Cruz, Representative Louie Gohmert, and a smattering of local officials recently at the state level. Legislators have authored Birch's bills that have made it further through the lawmaking process than many thought possible in Texas even just a few years ago. Though these are less the cause of the German Birch Society's influence than as indication of the rise of its particular strain of politics, these include bills that would forbid any government entity from participating in Agenda 21. I want to talk a little bit more about it when we come back from break, Sandy, because when you include Ted Cruz and Louie Gohmert, that's today. And so they're starting to make a change. Got to go to break, 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So.
WAUK 540 AM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Young guy's got some chops. Hey, come on. Where does a 21-year-old...
Who is this? Dave Brubeck? Who is this?
It's Miles Davis.
Miles Davis.
It's off Kinda Blue. It's John Coltrane on a...
Sandy. Nice. How can... So, how do you know anything about John Coltrane and Miles Davis?
I was really into jazz when I was in high school.
When you were young, Ken, are you going to say something like
that? No, when I was in high school.
Was so long ago, right?
Yeah.
I'm still into jazz, but I don't know. I just did research on it, and I looked up people to listen to, and I bought their vinyls. And
oh, you've got vinyls.
And I went on Spotify because you can find any artist on here pretty much.
So. Sandy, this guy is something special. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. This Friday's with Sandy Williams. And we're listening to John Coltrane and Miles Davis.
Yeah, I used to.
And I didn't request it.
No, it was cool. I used the break to brush up a little on the John Birch Society.
Yeah, let's realize that
it was actually Grand Chute near Appleton where it was headquartered. This guy, Robert Welch, this all came back to me in a flood as I was reading about it. Robert Welch, a candy maker, was sort of the founder of it. And it was definitely at the time sort of an echo of the McCarthy period. It was basically anti-communist. But it wrapped itself in the Constitution, using the Constitution as sort of the Christ and communists as the Antichrist, kind of a juxtaposition of discussion. And interestingly, as I was reading it there, it was the Reagan period. William Buckley, who was sort of the outstanding spokesman for the conservative movement, sort of the intellectual spokesman for it. And they wanted to purge the Republican Party of the influence of the Birch Society because their feeling was that the conservative movement would be tainted by what they viewed as the sort of encroaching fascism, that flavor that the Birch Society had in terms of its approach, which was ends justify the means, conservatism is the utmost importance, and their definition of conservatism was very conservative.
You know, Sandy, you mentioned Bill Buckley, and I recall as a young kid, I don't know, 16 years old or so, I would watch Bill Buckley on Firing Line. It would be him, and what's the other guy that was on there with him on the Democratic side of things? He hung around a long time.
Yes. Yeah.
And I used to watch those guys. You know, we didn't have cable and all those kind of things, but just, you know, when you talk about conservatism and watching how that evolved, I didn't really know at the time what it was I was watching, but I know I always would see it. But you know, Sandy, you look now at what the conservative movement is today. And Sandy, there's something brewing in the halls of conservatism that when the conservatives can kick a Liz Cheney out, and she loses by one of the largest numbers almost in the history of this nation for incumbent, you know, elected officials, and she loses by 38-39%. And as Liz Cheney, her dad, neocons, just a few years ago, there would have been no way possible. Well, that Liz Cheney could have lost.
Well, I think it's because really the Republican Party has lost its ideological moorings and has become a personality cult, and they respond to the personality leader, which is Donald Trump. And so the whole, you know, the reason she lost, everyone understands it, is because she voted for the impeachment of Donald Trump, along with Adam Kinzinger, who didn't even buy, he didn't run because he knew that he could see the writing on the wall. Both of them clearly put their own ethical positions ahead of the notion that political power for the party was the most important outcome. And that's, I think, what this is when I mentioned earlier that Buckley and Reagan and the leaders of the conservative movement in the 80s were concerned about the Birch Society, was that it had an ideological bent that could be repellent and it would be kind of fascist. Well, currently, it looks like only Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney have the ethical standards and sort of the backbone to stand up against power for its own for its own purposes. You know, the Republican Party and maybe the Democrats seem much more intent on doing whatever it is necessary to have the party in power than it is that they want to install some policy or have some moorings that are important to the American people.
So, Sandy, in your opinion, long term, this has to be damaging, or will be damaging to the Republican Party. There's no way possible that whoever they were, prior to Donald Trump, they're not anymore.
Well, if our republic is to last in its current form, it will be damaging to the Republican Party. If it isn't damaging to the Republican Party, and if the Republican Party thrives in this power over principle kind of a outlook, then it might be a watershed time when the Republican Party becomes essentially something much more like an autocratic, the party of power, not the party in power. And I'm afraid that that's what they're trying to create, this restriction on voting and all of the things that are being taken, all the steps being pursued by the Republican Party are an attempt to create the Republican Party a party of power rather than the party which is temporarily in power.
You know, Sandy, and all of that then dismisses the people, right? I mean, the people, the average people that they supposedly were there to support and fight for,
yeah,
don't even come into the picture anymore.
Well, I think it has to do with this saving the fabric of American society, the concept that they're going to save America from itself. They're going to save America from the people. Essentially, that is essentially the current refrain amongst the super conservatives is we're going to save America from the people.
Got to go to a break. I'll see you on the phone lines. We'll come to you after the break. It's Fridays with Sandy Williams. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back.